she is out. Okay, everybody, I want to welcome you. It's Thursday night. This is our Purim edition. But our Purim edition is not going to be based around humor because I got together with the lay leadership of the shul today to send out the FAQ that hopefully you got a chance to see.
Yes.
I have to say that almost all of my jokes were rejected in the Q&A. Only one of them stayed. The rest of them were replaced by somebody's neighbor who shall remain nameless. But if you read the fine print, you'll figure out who it was. And it was done very well to his credit. So I can't, in advance, when you read it, I can't take the credit for anything funny except for the Zeresh joke, right? Which, as I said in shul tonight, may not even be such a funny joke. It may be reality. But other than that, all my jokes got removed. So I'll have to save them for the daf. Yeah, learning in the shul this week is sponsored once again by the Rosenzweigs, commemorating three important Yahrzeits in their family, and we hope that their neshamos have an aliyah. So, okay, Purim edition means what? Means that we're going to look at two questions this week. They're both going to be practical. Both questions, one has a history, and Dina knows part of the history, but I told her, hey, Dina, you're going to have to hear the rest of the story if that's the question you vote for, or if we have time to do both of them. So let me get to the beginning. This year is a year where Purim falls out on Friday. It's also a COVID year. So I was listening, Rebbetzin Efrat Sabalovsky is a very important person in the world. She's a terrific person, Rebbetzin Dr. Sabalovsky. She is a person in her own right. She's a Rebbetzin in Teaneck. She's the head of a very important organization called YU Connects. She's also responsible for saving my life on more than one occasion many, many years ago. And her younger brother, Dr. Ron Samet, is the original founder of the Internet Chabur, which graces itself every single week inside our announcement sheet. He's the one who encouraged it and wanted it to happen. So I'm a big fan of Rebbetzin Sabalovsky. And her husband, Rabbi Sabalovsky, is one of the great Rosh Yeshiva at YU, gave a class and last night or the night before. And Rebbetzin Sabalovsky meant to send it to somebody else, and I guess named Schwartz, and it wound up in my email. So, you know, I listened to this year. Rabbi Sabalovsky pointed out that, you know, on a given year, when Purim falls out on Friday, it creates a whole series of questions and should have had a whole bunch of issues that should have come up on the table. And COVID is, you know, constantly around the clock placed questions on the table. So when you have COVID and a Purim on a Friday, right, you're definitely going to have questions. Two came up this week. And I felt they were both deserving of our time, our way of thinking, and try to figure out how we put things together. Both will have far, far reaching, well beyond this year, and well beyond, by the way, even this one instance. You'll see what I mean. Question number one, I become aware of the COVID-19 restrictions and the need for proper social distancing. I'm also aware of the safety in pods. What's a pod? A pod is like the people that you live with, or your small group. You're a lot safer around those people because the assumption is if you're alone in that group is likely to live together, be together. If one gets COVID, ach and vey for the whole pod. But on the other side, if you're podding, right, P-O-D-D-I-N-G, right, you can pretty much guarantee that you're safe with that group because you guys are together all the time. So I'm quite thankful that the shul goes to great lengths to make sure that everyone can hear the Megillah in the safest way possible. Could we arrange to have a Megillah reading where families would be able to sit together in order to hear the Megillah, cutting down on the number of different spaces needed? Because remember, if we sit family style, so what today would be one seat, we can actually sit three people within that range and then just extend the 8 feet beyond that, as opposed to needing, you know, three different seats with 8 feet in between. Or is there a need to have a mechitza? That's question number one. Again, can we sit family style for Megillah, or does it need a mechitza? And of course, in advance, before you give your answer, realize I'm not just interested in your answer. I want to know why, when, where, how, etc. Question number two, Purim is on a Friday this year. There are a lot of things to prepare for. I saw your slideshow, and hopefully you did, or you got to see the video recreation, and reviewed the requirements, including that of having a suda. I just got off the phone with a member of our shul who was asking me, wait a minute, we have to have a suda this year? Can we just make it a Friday night suda? The answer is no, right? And I saw that you said that there needs to be a Suda and that it should have meat and bread. And it got me thinking, can I just serve the same food for Purim Suda and then take the leftovers and use them for Shabbos or not? Do I need to have a specific meal for Shabbos and a specific meal for Purim, right? That's one side and one question. The other question is the question about the mechitza. Any favorites? Anyone want to vote? No, yes, Dina? No? No difference? Okay, so we'll start at the beginning because the first question, I think, will take a little bit more time. It also happens to be Parsha related. How is it Parsha related, my dear Dr. Wenger?
Parsha Zachar.
No, actually, this first question, I think, is Parsha related. Actually, before you get to Parsha Zachar, this is one of those weird years where Parsha's Truma is Parsha's Zachar. Most years, most non-leap years, 7 times out of 19 years, every 19 years, it's a leap year. So we're in the book of Vayikra by the time we get to Parsha Zachor. But this year, we're not going to be in that situation. On the non-leap years, most years, we are reading Parsha's Tetzaveh, right? When we read Parsha's, in fact, it's funny, when you read through all the commentaries, all the rabbis who like to talk about these parshios. So when they get to Parshas Tetzaveh, they always manage to draw a connection to the Megillah, right? Like, wait, where did that come from? What I think in the current cycle, it has happened 3 times in my lifetime, maybe 4 times. Certainly, the last time that Parshas Truma was read as Parshas Zachor was the year 2001, and the next time I think will also be a long time from now. It was just my friend Rabbi Tzvi Harari happened to send it to me. He went to one of the great calendar experts whose last name is not Tites. There's a rabbi in Baltimore named Rabbi David Heber, and Rabbi Heber is a recognized expert on the calendar. And Rabbi Harari sent me a note today to tell me, yeah, by the way, the last time this happened, you and I were walking around together in. He used to give my share on Sunday mornings in Fifth Avenue Synagogue in the year 2001. He says, we were probably around together that particular time. And you should just know that that was the last time. So it's been a while. I thought of you today. How are you? How's it going? Right? So what are we talking? 20 years since the last time? That's pretty impressive distance in time. Anyway, so in Parshas Truma, what do we talk about?
The Mishkan.
What about the Mishkan?
All the things in it.
Yes, including how to set it up and other things. One of the things we know about the Mishkan is that there were designated spaces for everything. And like in the Beis HaMikdash, one of the areas that was designated was the difference between an Ezrat Nashim and an Ezrat Yisrael. We also, by the way, talk about a kli called the Paroches, a utensil called the Paroches, so which is used to separate Vivdila Paroches Lachem Bein HaKodesh Ubein Kodesh HaKadashim, that the Parochas is also supposed to separate. Okay, it doesn't separate between men and women. It serves as a separation between areas of Kodesh and the area of the Holy of Holies. So this, the fact that we are talking in the awkward year about the idea of the Mechitza, and Parshas Truma proves what, my dear Dr. Wenger?
It's all connected.
It's all connected. Everything is connected. This is not happenstance. It's not something on the side. So let's take a minute to first understand this idea of a mechitza, right? If we understand what mechitza is all about and when it applies and when it doesn't apply, then we'll be able to decide, do we need one for a Megillah leaning? Do we not need one? When yes, when no? Seems like a good use of our time, no? So let's start at the beginning. When can you last remember a mechitza and a separation between men and women?
This morning.
Okay. And when was the first time that you remember reading about or learning about a mechitza in history, Jewish history?
Oh, in Jewish history?
Yes.
The Beis HaMikdash?
Yes, when? Okay, so there is a Mishnah in this. The Mishnah in Masechta Sukkah tells us that there was a very famous party that was held every year on a particular holiday known as Sukkos. And what was the party called?
Simchat Beit Har.
Yeah. Shoeva, very good. The Mishnah tells us on Daf Nun Aleph Amen Aleph, Misha lo ra simchas besa shoeva, lo ra simcha miyamav. If a person didn't see the simchas besa shoeva, that person really didn't get to know what simcha was all about. And the Mishnah goes on and says, b'motze yom tov harishon shel chag, after the first day of Yantiv. Now, of course, since this was in Israel, they only kept one day, so we're talking about the second night, right? What did they do? Yardu le'ezras nashim. They went to the Ezras Nashim, umesaknin sham tikun gadol, and they would put up and erect a major structure. The Gemara goes on to try to figure out, what is this tikun gadol? What's this big corrective device that you were doing? So the Gemara in Daf Nun Aleph Amud Beis, going on to Nun Beis Amud Aleph, tells us that they would put up a special gezustera. They would set up, according to the way Rashi understands it, they installed rods into the walls of the Beis HaMikdash, and they would put planks on top of the rods, and they would create a balcony. And this is the first Ezras Nashim. According to the Rambam, he says in Hilchos Beis HaBechira that it was there so that women could see from above without any intermingling between men and women. What was the concern? If men and women were going to be around during this great big party, then all sorts of danger could come out. Because of the intermingling, people just start to act a little bit wild. The music, you know what they say. I think in my office, sometimes I get off as I'm walking down the hall, you hear the music in the hallway, and there's one song that plays a lot called "The Rhythm Is Gonna Get You." The rhythm's gonna get you. The rhythm's gonna get you. The rhythm's gonna get you tonight. Well, if that night happens to be Simchas Beis HaShoeva, we want to stop the rhythm getting you. Right, because we're afraid that it's going to lead to some sort of difficulty. In fact, Rav Kook says that there is a little bit of a differentiation between Rashi's understanding that they put the rods into the wall of the Beis HaMikdash and put up the planks, and the Rambam's understanding that we always had a terrace up there. And he says, according to Rashi, throughout the year they didn't have to have a mechitza. What separated men and women in the Beis HaMikdash? The 15 steps, right? And according to the Rambam, it was only during Simchas Beis HaShoeva, according to Rashi, says Rav Kook, that you needed to have a separation. And that's why they set up this extra piece. But according to the Rambam, you had to have something there all the time. And on Sukkot, they just added and made it a little bit taller to separate and add different levels of tznius. But what exactly, based on that source, that being the early source of mechitza, what was the purpose of a mechitza? Why do we have a mechitza? So the Rambam, in his explanation of the Mishnah, says they put the women on top so that the men shouldn't be staring up at the women, right? And the Chasam Sofer adds that we separate men and women and we place a mechitza there so that when people are involved in tefillah, they should not have impure thoughts. And so he doesn't quote the Rambam. He doesn't quote the Tosis Yontif, who quotes the Rambam. He says when we are concerned about frivolity, what we're worried about is something called hirhur. And so again, according to this particular approach, the goal of a mechitza is to prevent people from having impure thoughts, right? In the context of davening. When you're davening, you need to have a focus. Of course, in the Beis HaMikdash, the davening was the service. You need to have a proper focus, and that's the goal of the mechitza. But Moshe Feinstein writes a series of tshuvas. They all begin in Or HaChaim, Chelek Aleph. They can be found between Simon Lamed Tes and Simon Mem Gimel. And Rav Moshe says, first of all, he thinks this idea of having a mechitza and a shul is a din del raisa. And he says, the Gemara says, the question is, we install a gezuster in a Beis HaMikdash. If having a mechitza is only a requirement in the Rabbanan, how could we ever allow it in the Beis HaMikdash, right? How do you add something to a Beis HaMikdash just to protect something in the Rabbanan? Then Rav Moshe and another tshuva says the purpose of making a separation was to prevent not so much hirhurim, the thoughts, as much as to prevent people from intermingling, right? And this would be accomplished the way they did it in the Beis HaMikdash with a balcony. If you can't do that, so Moshe says, so at least put up something that separates people at a shoulder height, because you'd have to jump over the shoulder height thing to go ahead and actually be standing together. But to say you can't see each other, Moshe says that's not that's not the problem. So Rav Moshe says, ten tfachim, a mechitza of ten tfachim, approximately 60 feet, right? Should be, I'm sorry, a mechitza of ten tfachim, which is not 60 feet, it's a lot less than that. He says, that's a lot less. It's about 3 feet, right? And that's not really enough to prevent people from intermingling, right? Because that's like something you step over, right? So he says, however, but if it gets up to shoulder height, people don't really have, they don't start intermingling over that issue. Now, Rav Moshe adds one less issue, which is worthy of mention as we're talking about mechitza. He says there's another reason why we might need to raise the size of the mechitza. And what's that? If the women come to shul inappropriately dressed, or they won't cover their hair, or whatever the case is, then a person's not allowed to daven when you're facing an erva, right? So even though one wants to rely on the Orach HaShulchan and say the reason why women don't cover their hair in the streets is because it's commonplace, but Rav Moshe says you can't do that in a shul. A man is not allowed to recite Dvarim Shebekdusha in front of a woman who's not dressed appropriately or is not following the rules of Tznius. And so therefore, what if I had a glass mechitza that is shoulder length? So he says, look, assuming all the women would be appropriately dressed, right? Can you go through a piece of glass?
No.
So therefore, according to Rav Moshe, what should the halacha be? Such a mechitza should be okay. According to the Chasam Sofer, what are you, nuts? The Chasam Sofer is like, how could you have that? You'd be people staring at the men are staring at the women. It's going to create all sorts of inappropriate thoughts, right? And, you know, who agrees with the Chasam Sofer's position? The famous Satmar Rebbe, Rabbi Yoelish Teitelbaum. And so he says, Rabbi Yoelish turns around and says, you can't have a mechitza that has any possibility of a man seeing a woman, right? That's off the wall. You can't even look at a two-dimensional image of women, right? You have to take them out and scratch them out of the magazines. Just kidding about that. That's, but the understanding that Rabbi Yoel Teitelbaum felt in a shul, that you have to, it has to be bigger because the issue is men shouldn't be staring at women during the davening. So again, we have two different major approaches among the poskim to the purposes of the mechitza. And both seem to be directly connected to the davening. What is that? According to Rav Moshe Feinstein, the issue is a concern that couples should not be, that men and women, due to separate genders, should not be intermingling. According to the Satmar Rebbe and the Hungarian poskim Chasam Sofer and others, the issue isn't just intermingling. The issue is improper thoughts, seeing one another, and thus being distracted from our primary purpose, which is Avodas Hashem, either in the Beis Hamikdash through the temple services, or today in our modern form of temple service, in other words, what you and I call tefillah. Should just be pointed out that Rabbi Chil Yaakov Weinberg, the famous author of the Sri De'esh, was a Rav in Montreux after the war. He says he thinks Rav Moshe is correct. And when we say that men shouldn't be staring at the women, he's talking about staring. But if you look up and you see a woman for a second here and there, right, that's not really much of an issue, right? The purpose of having a mechitza is that we don't want people spending their whole davening staring at their wives, or staring at somebody else's wife, God forbid, right? We want people not to be gazing around. Okay, so that being the case, if I stopped here and I asked the question, what do we do about Megillah? Right, so Rav Moshe would say to you, look, if you're sitting in pods, right, it really shouldn't present a difficulty, right? Why? Because you're not going to intermingle, right? On the other side of it, within each pod, a husband and wife sitting together, you may have a problem. According to the Satmar Rebbe, according to the Hungarian poskim, what are you, out of your noodle? Whoever heard of having such a practice, right? It's inappropriate for a Beis HaMikdash. It's inappropriate for a Mikdash Ma'at. Nikuda, hold that for a second. Hold that point, because I think I subtly slipped something in there and you may not have noticed it. Let me ask you a different question. What if I'm davening outside of shul? Do I need a mechitza then?
Outdoors, you mean?
Outside of a shul.
Well,
it depends who you're holding on. If you shouldn't be intermingling, then it's one thing, but if you shouldn't even see the person, then you need a mechitza because you're davening. You can't be, because you're not going to have the right thoughts.
So let me ask you a question. I'm flying on an airplane, right? Let's forget about whether I should be all gathering in the back for the minion. That we've talked about on other occasions. I'm in my seat, right? But do I have to tell the ladies that they have? I'm sorry, you can't. Can you all put the blanket over your heads for the next half an hour? Because I need to go daven right now? Or do we do something else? So Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Halicho Shlomo Tfila Perek Ches Os Dalit says, a person is allowed to daven in a minyan on an airplane, assuming that it's not going to disturb the other passengers, even though there's no mechitza there. Why? Because believe it or not, next to the bathroom by the galley is actually not supposed to be set up as a minyan spot, right? It's not a shul. There's a difference between a shul and a catch-all space. But putting this into another instance, you know, once upon a time, people got married at big, large chasnas, right? Once upon a time, being pre-COVID. And Be'ezus Hashem will get there again soon. And even at the smaller weddings, you know, it's very often that after the chuppah and the chasna and kala go into yichud, what's the first thing that happens? Someone screams either mincha or ma'ariv. And then where do the people go? They go down the block to the shul? No, they find itinerant locations all over the place, because you can't have Jews daven together in the same spot, God forbid, right? You have to have, this guy has to have his minion, and that guy has to have another minion. These people came late. Those people started early. But you have 15 different minyanim going on all over the wedding hall or the JEC dinner, right? Even though Rabbi Titus is so particular, he always wants a one minion, right? Notwithstanding, do the women need to worry over there? Does Steve Karp have to show up with a portable mechitza and stretch it out? So that I always said that Rabbi Titus always finds the best time for the dinner, for the minion at the dinner. Why is that? Because he always does it during dessert, right? It's always like during dessert. So it's good for me, because otherwise I would definitely be all over that dessert table. Right, so instead, I can't bring myself not to this. By the time I'm done, Tammy's had whatever she wanted to eat, and we're ready to go home. I never get the cookies. It's good for me. It's better that way, right? But technically speaking, do we have to put up a mechitza in that situation?
Yeah.
Why not?
It's not a shul. It's a public space.
Exactly. However, I do need to point out to you that Ramosha says. That a public place that is set aside for a davening purpose obviously would need a mechitza, but a private place doesn't. So let's say I'm making a minyan in a shiva home. This happened to us on a couple of occasions where, you know, you're in a shiva house. We have a wonderful chevra kedisha. Now's a good time for me to plug them, because Zayin Adar is coming up, right? So we have wonderful chevra kedisha, and one of the many functions that they do is they will bring over materials to a shiva home if we were having minyanim. These days, we are very strongly cautioning against, especially, and will not allow it if it's indoor. But, you know, hopefully the COVID situation improves. And unfortunately, you know, if we need to make a prom minyan for somebody in a shiva house, sometimes it happens that there's more than one person sitting shiva. They're not all of the same gender. So the other person has to go into the kitchen, right? You know, what do you do? What do you do? You have 15 people there, 10 men and 5 women, right? You can't daven because the women are in the house? What kind of nonsense is that? So the Ramosha says, in a shiva home, ideally women should leave the room. Why? Because why don't you stand around? They're going to stand around and talk, and that's not a good idea. They want to daven. So, you know, then it's a question of finding the right place. But Ramosha says, if they don't leave the room or they can't leave the room, it's not a big deal. It's temporary, right? It's a temporary spot. It's not a permanent shul, right? They should move over to the side. Same thing with Sheva Brachas. There's a big discussion, right? This is Ramoshin Orachaim Chelakei Simen Yud Beis. And he says, what's his language over here? Let me just read it to you. It's great. I will be Beis Chasan. In the house of a chassan, medina in tzorach b'mechitza, sheina pasuch l'rabim. It's not open for anybody who feels like walking in the door, right? Ela rak l'bnei hamishpacha. It's there for the invited guests. לכן די בכך שיוכלו אנשים המספללים לזוף השחש, שיוכלו לחבים שם, ושם יספללו. They should go to a separate spot, right? It's better for concentration, because everyone else is schmoozing, right? And they should daven over there. But to say you need a mechitza, that's crazy. Is it really so crazy now that we mentioned Sheva Brachas? The answer is it shouldn't be so crazy. And why is that? We do find a very major discussion among the poskim in Eben HaEzer as to whether one can recite the phrase Baruch Shasimcha b'mo'ono v'shachal n'mishal, the simchas in the home. So Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, the famous author of the Sefer HaChassidim, not to be confused with being a chassid. Being a chassid means to be a student of the Baal Shem Tov. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid lived in the 1100s, right? He lived between 1150 and 1217. Rest assured, the Baal Shem Tov wasn't going to be around for another 600-700 years. So the whole Hasidic movement wasn't started yet. So Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid writes that if men and women are sitting together at Sheva Brachos, you can't say Shasimcha b'me'ono because it's a place where people have impure thoughts. So Rabbi Yehuda Sirkish, the famous author of the Bach, comes along 400 years later and he says the minhag in Krakow was taka that way, that when you made a Sheva Brachos and they didn't say Shasimcha b'me'ono, it was just standard, which teaches you what about the people of Krakow? Which brings us back to our conversation this morning in the Daf Yomi. What does it teach you about the people of Krakow? They sat mixed, right? Clearly, they said it was a standard practice. Nobody said Shasimcha b'mono. So Rabbi Yehuda Sirkish goes, I don't know why they didn't say Shasimcha b'mono. He says, oh wait, everybody sits mixed. Since everyone sits mixed, and Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid said not to say Shasimcha b'mono, so we forgot that there was such a phrase, Shasimcha b'mono. Nobody ever says it anymore, out of respect for Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, even though the practice was to sit mixed. Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid said you can't say it because he didn't want people to sit mixed. It's one of those kooky things where the minhag, where the practice out of respect was a disrespect, right? He said, don't say Shasimcha b'mono, encourage people not to sit mixed. So people just decide, we won't sit mixed, and we'll never say Shasimcha b'mono, right? It's just like one of those funky things that have. We have a number of them. I was talking about this between Mincha and Marv tonight in regard to making noise, during Hamans, right? So anyway, it seems that the Bach doesn't have this problem. The Levush, already moving into the early 1600s, he says the practice was that people just, they sat together, and there was no concern of hearer, which is why, Bizman Hazeh, people all say, you go to Sheva Brachos, what do they say? And nobody ever thinks the wiser. Nobody says, oh, we shouldn't do that because people are sitting mixed. Doesn't even happen anymore. It's already based on the Levush and the Bach. Already in their times, that's the way it was. Now, Rav Moshe says, sure, Rav Moshe, Orach Chaim, Chelek Aleph, Siman Men Aleph writes that for activities that aren't obligatory, a wedding, etc., there's absolutely no need for a mechitza. I had a chance on more than one occasion to discuss this issue with Rav David Zatzal and Rav Reuven Feinstein. And they told, I think the last time I asked them about this, Rav Reuven says, you always have to ask my brother, Rav David. And then when I asked him, Reuven looks at Rodon and he goes, your wedding didn't have a mechitza. Yours, right? So he says, neither of our weddings had mechitzas. The only wedding that Rav Moshe family sat separate was whose? Dina, you know whose? Take this one home to Moshe. It was the Tendler wedding. Rabbi Tendler's wedding. Why? So both of them goes, that was different. That was because of Rabbi Tendler. Rabbi Tendler's father, Zatzal, right? It was his side of the family that was makrid. True story, was there, heard it from them, didn't confirm it with Rabbi Tendler, but Rav David and Rav Reuven don't need my support for this story. The Feinstein family ate together when they made chasnas. So Rav Moshe says he didn't understand what the problem is, right? And on private issues, right? It's not going to be an issue. And he even quotes that he quotes from the daf, from the daf of the other day, where we talked about the one person who turned away to face the wall. Who faced the wall when eating the Karban Pesach?
The Kala.
But guess what? Her mother and her mother-in-law did not. So Moshe says clearly, She had, and if you look at Rashi over there, Rashi says, because of her embarrassment, not because it's the halacha, right? So Moshe says, you see that on non-obligatory places, there is no need to go ahead and insist that there be a mechitza. So what does this do for us and the question we started with? So let's begin, right? Let's start plugging things back together. Now we understand the idea of mechitza, when we apply it, when we don't apply it. If you're of a Hungarian descent, anytime there is a question of men and women, there should be a separation. It doesn't matter. You're doing something religious or something that looks religious, probably even Mikra Megillah, unless you're the father or the husband reading for your own spouse. And even then, probably, maybe you should have some sort of separation or mechitza. I don't know that for sure. I didn't check with my my friends who are poskim in the Hasidish community, but I would imagine that other than for your own immediate family, you're always sitting behind the mechitza. That's the way of the because of the problem of hirurim, of the distractibility. But if we live in the world of Ramosha Feinstein, where what's our concern? Intermingling, not distractibility. Where are we concerned about intermingling? Where was that applicable? Only in situations that are strict, only things that are obligatory, which means, and only in places where those obligations are kavua, right, where they're established. So when this shiloh came up, especially this year, I don't have enough mechitzas to bring them to all the different locations that we will likely have Megillah laning at one time. So Rabbi Tait said to me, when I asked him, he said to me, he did not think that in a non-Beis HaKnesses, a place that doesn't have a minyan kavua, right, that there was a problem with family style, only for this year. You make a change, all of a sudden everyone starts thinking we're conservative now or we're reform. Everyone sits wherever they feel like. Says, but for this year, in a place that is not a minyan kavua, it would be okay. Sure enough, when we were meeting with Mori Virabi, with Rav Schechter, right, and the question came up beforehand, Rav Schechter did say, in a place that's not a minyan kavua, to do it in a shul is a big problem, right? It's a big problem. It's a place you're doing dvarim shebekdusha, you're involved in, you're doing mitzvos, not dvarim shebekdusha. You're doing mitzvos in a shul, in a place that's a makom kadosh. Maybe in that situation, a person should make sure that there's an appropriate separation. But if it's not a set makom kavua for tefillah, Rav Schechter also thought there was plenty of room to be lenient. Which leads me to the following revelation. Purim night at AI, at least at the first Megillah laning, and I say laning rather smiley because it's not laning. It will be about seven lanings that will be going on at the exact same time in seven different locations. The two locations that are primarily tefillah locations, which is really two out of three because there's also a third location, that have Aron Kodesh, that are places where we have regular minyanim going on, those places will have mechitzos as well, and we are going to be strict. In fact, in the Bruria gym, we probably will not be having a mechitza at all, but we also won't be having women in that room, right? The understanding being that that is a makom kavua litvila, and so therefore in that place, there will not be any possibility of potting. But if I'm not mistaken, the game plan in the other locations is that, yes, we're necessary to fill in the gaps, right? We will be sitting by pod, and by that opportunity, it will allow us to maximize the number of people who can hear the Megillah at the same time. During the day, it's less of a problem. And why is that? Because during the day, we have multiple minyanim going on at multiple times. So the people who want to daven at 6:20 don't really mind that much. If the numbers spread themselves out better. At night, everyone wants to get to that. We have such an excitement to go run and hear the Megillah, right? So that it sounds like people are much more pressured. But otherwise, we'll be using some of the rooms that are not regularly utilized. And that's the first section. Maybe should we go a little bit further just to get to the second question? Okay, but that's the issue. And the first question we'll understand. We're almost finished. The second question, I think, is more exciting. And I will let you in on Adina's secret. right? So Dina and I have a very good friend, Rabbi Aryeh Leibowitz. I quite like to quote him very much. He's a very dear, special friend and Talmud Chacham, and he gives a lot of wonderful shiurim. So when I posted, tell me if you don't want me to tell this story, right? So I posted the questions yesterday, and I get a note from Dina. She says to me, oh, you got quoted on that question yesterday by Rabbi Leibowitz. So I said to you, don't worry, Dina, I have more to add, and I'll tell you now the rest of the story. So we have a very good relationship with a number of our friends, all of whom happen to be rabbis. So, of course, in between what do rabbis talk about, at least hopefully the Yankees, the Mets, you know, whatever's going on in the world, but, you know, but when you're really serious, we also share sometimes best practices and best questions. So another friend of ours, Rabbi Yechiel Morris from Michigan, who's a very, very, very close friend of mine. So he puts out this question, the question about the leftovers. He says he thought it was fascinating. What do people think? And without missing a beat, I said to myself, wait, I think this question is not a Purim question. I think it's a Shabbos question. And it's less of a Shabbos question. It's a Friday question, right? And the Gemara tells us, the Torah tells us, that V'haya b'yom ha'shishi v'ichino eis asher yaviyu. And I ran through most of the question with Rabbi Leibowitz, and Dina heard the last 2 minutes of this year where Rabbi Leibowitz found 2 minutes of whatever I say to him to be useful, so he gave me the credit. But that's not really the end of the story, and I'll give you the end of the story in the beginning. The Torah tells us on Friday, the Echinu Eis Asher Yaviyu, that when it came to the man, we're told already start preparing on Friday for that which you're going to bring. That there's a responsibility to prepare for Shabbos, and it's based, the Devorah will tell you, it's a Gemara in Shabbos on Daf Kuf Yud Zayin Amud Beis, where the Gemara says that a person should get up early to start preparing on Friday, early in the morning. Remember the Gemara? The Gemara says, Yashkim Adam, that a person should get up early on Friday to prepare for Shabbos. In fact, so what about staying up late Thursday night? Maybe it's better to stay up late on Thursday night. So the Ariya Kadosh and Chara Kavanos, which is a Kabbalistic work, page 64, Amud number 4, when you have two columns on a page. So page Samach Dalet can have an Amud Aleph, an Amud Beis, an Amud Gimel, and an Amud Dalet. You have four columns, you can have four Amudim. So in the fourth one, he says, no, you really should prepare on Friday. Don't prepare the Thursday. Because in Kabbalistic works, preparing for Shabbos on Friday is more appropriate. Now the Gemara in Tanis seems to go against this idea that the Ari brings down. How so? Because the Gemara in Tanis talks about what happens when you have a fast day that's on a Thursday, right? And it's one of the more intense fasts. Like, for instance, there's no rain, so they set up a series of fast days. Monday, Thursday. So when the Thursday fast came around, even if it was in the later ones, close to the month of Adar, right? Thus again, proving that what, my dear Dr. Wanger, it's all connected. So we say that the intensity of those last number of fasts, that people wouldn't work during the day, but the markets, when it was a Thursday fast, the markets would be open, L'Kavod Shabbos. So it sounds like the Gemara in Taina seems to suggest, Hasmama and Aleph, that fasts need to be constructed to make sure that the markets are open for for Thursday. Is it Thursday that you're supposed to prepare for Shabbos, or Friday that you're supposed to prepare for Shabbos? So Rashi says, that's not really much of a question. It depends what you're making. Right. If you're talking about something that has to have a longer prep time, so then you have to start on Thursday, right? Otherwise, the closer the Shabbos, the better the food. Not much of a problem. The Gemara in Beitza, though, on Daf Taz, Rabbi Leibowitz says to me, what about the Gemara in Beitza? There's a Gemara in Beitza on Daf Taz Zayin Amud Aleph, which notes that there are two different styles of living, Shammai style and Hillel style. Shammai style was, he lived constantly for L'Kavod Shabbos. Anytime he found something exciting during the week, he tucked it away and he used it for Shabbos, right? Hillel focused each and every day because he said, each and every day you live, you should live l'shem shamayim. Whom do we paskin like?
Hillel.
Usually that's what you would say. But the poskim seem to say that Hillel would agree to Shammai as alechatchila. Right? Alechatchila in life, we should make sure that we elevate what we do and so that we're always looking forward to moving towards a Shabbos, right? Not only that, there's a mitzvah called Oneg Shabbos. And what is Oneg Shabbos? The Gemara says it's a din d'oraisa. It's how so? Because the Gemara says it's halach l'moshe mi-Sinai. And the Shalosh Teshuvos Tzemach Tzedek and the Pri Megadim and the Psicha Kol Elis all say that therefore Oneg Shabbos is a din d'oraisa. And the Gemara in Shabbos Kuf Yud Ches Amud Beis says that at least something that is small, even if it's a something small, it has to be prepared specifically for Shabbos in order for a person to be able to fulfill the mitzvah of Oneg Shabbos. So let's bring this back into our question, right? We asked the question, can I just use my leftovers from Friday? Well, the Shulchan Aruch and Aruch Chaim Simen Reish Nun Sif Aleph says, a person should say, even if you have a number of servants, Yishtadel Lachachin Be'atzbon Shum Davar L'Tzarchei Shabbos Kedei L'Chabdo. No matter what happens, right? You should. We know the Amorim went out of their way to do special activities L'Chabod Shabbos, right? One guy cut the wood and one guy went chopping. One guy lit the fires. One guy salted the fish. Some people were assaulted by fish, whatever the case may be, right? But however it works, by the way, mentioning fish in the month of Adar shows what?
Pisces.
That's all, and therefore?
It's all connected.
So based on this, we see that there's something to do with already on Friday getting ready for Shabbos. Rav Nissen Karel at Zecher Tzadik Livracha passed away last year in his Sefer Chut HaShani on Shabbos, Chelek Aleph 84:1. He notes that there are two aspects to the idea of preparing for Shabbos. The first one is that you have to make sure that we have needs of Shabbos prepared. But if you already had leftovers, that would be good enough. But he says, more close to our issue is that you have a mitzvah to prepare for Shabbos. Because as you prepare for Shabbos, you are showing kavod Shabbos, right? And so therefore, you can't toss that to the side, right? Not only that, so therefore, you need to designate something specifically for Shabbos. So as I said to my friend Rabbi Leibowitz and to my friend Rabbi Morris, I said, guys, I think it's pretty clear that this is a general issue. If I had great food left over from who knows when, and I want to serve it on Shabbos, the answer is that may be okay, but there should be a special dish, something that's created specifically for Shabbos. And that would seem to be the way it is. So what did I get quoted on? I mentioned as a matter of fact, in course, and this is what, Dina, this is what I think you heard Rabbi Leibowitz quote me on. In addition, there is a comment of the Chafetz Chaim. The Chafetz Chaim in his Sefer Shem Olam at the end of the fourth parak, he says that he who prepares from Shabbos, we know that that person gets released from Gehenna on Shabbos, right? In other words, if you're sentenced to whatever time in Gehenna, but if you prepared for Shabbos, so you get a furlough every Shabbos. Now, when does the furlough begin? So the Chafetz Chaim says, he says, he doesn't know who he heard it from, but he heard from a Zakein Echad, he heard from one old man somewhere, that time is dependent when you started to prepare for Shabbos. And so there are a lot of benefits for preparing for Shabbos, right? If you prepare every week for Shabbos, you get out again, and the earlier you start, what does that mean? It's sort of like a longer...
On Monday and Sunday you prepare for Shabbos.
Whatever it is, you get out of Gehenna longer for Shabbos that way, right? This is, so again, can you use the leftovers? I think you could substitute the leftovers to fill in, but to say that I'm only serving the leftovers from the Purim Suda, I think that's 1,000% incorrect. So my friend Rabbi Leibowitz mentions, he remembers a couple of years ago, when Purim fell out on a Friday, he received a number of kugels and challahs for Shabbos, right? So I said to him, I see a difference between taking a kugel and designating the kugel as the Shabbos kugel, right? Just because it got sent to you through the Shalach Manos bag instead of the one-stop bag, I don't think that's what we're talking about. But if you prepared the kugel for Purim Suda and the leftovers for Shabbos, that's where I think you would have a problem. He agreed with me. He heard that differentiation, right? That if you're getting something extra, you're getting something extra. However, my friend David Lichtenstein, the famous podcast headlines, or last week's show, parenthetically, where he was not talking about anything related, drops the following atom bomb. He says, we live in such a world today where kids don't have the experience of seeing preparation for Shabbos. Because where does Shabbos come from? The counter at the local supermarket or the caterer. And so we have a responsibility to also create an era of Shabbos. So as I was mentioning this to Rabbi Shapiro, my dear friend, our dear friend from the shul. So Rabbi Shapiro says to me, he says, that's one of the great lines that Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky used to say. First, we have to fight the battle for Shabbos. Now we are living in a world where we have to fight the battle for Erev Shabbos, that people have to start getting ready and the idea of getting ready for Erev Shabbos. So can you use the leftovers? I still say yes, but to supplement. And as opposed to making it the whole meal, but to have nothing special for Shabbos, I think you're losing out on the mitzvah of Oneg Shabbos. I'll close on one last note, though. It says, I'm getting ready to prepare for tonight's shiur and typing up my notes. I said, wait a minute, I forgot something. And what did I forget? There is another mitzvah. What is the mitzvah? In Orachayim, Simen Tav Resh, Pehei, Sif Beis, where we talk about the Suda. You know, there's also, there's an idea that one is, that Yarbe, a person should add to his Suda or her Suda, both on the 14th of Adar and on the 15th. In other words, even if I'm not in Yerushalayim or a walled city from the time of Yoshua ben Nun, I still have a responsibility to do what? To have a special added Suda on Shushan Purim, right? Add. Now, when Rosh Chodesh
falls out. Because we don't say Tachnun.
You don't say Tachnun, right? So when the day happens to be Shabbos already and my meal is already bigger, what do I do? So we just had this last week. We had the same Shaila. Why? What was unique about last week? Do you remember what last Shabbos was? Last Shabbos was Shabbos Rosh Chodesh, right? And when Shabbos is Rosh Chodesh, we have the same problem. We don't have a special Sudas Rosh Chodesh because how many meals are you supposed to eat on Shabbos? 17 meals on Shabbos is a little crazy. So what are we told to do? So ideally what we're told to do is add a special dish L'chavad Rosh Chodesh. So my wife said to me, this Shabbos, we're having a deli roll. Why? Because we don't have deli roll every single Shabbos. But I said, you know, we should have something special for Rosh Chodesh. So the kids had an extra dish instead of one kugel. There was a kugel and a deli roll. Woo-wee! It was an exciting Shabbos, right? But that was the Rosh Chodesh deli roll. So now my kids think that deli roll is something you only get on Rosh Chodesh when Rosh Shabbos is Rosh Chodesh. I don't know if that's what they're going to come away with. But the bottom line is you add something. So what about next Shabbos? Not this Shabbos. This Shabbos is Shabbos Zachar. You just have to think about it. Remember it. Now, by next Shabbos, I think that the same question will come up, right? Can I use the leftovers as the extra piece for the meal? So, Doc, I want you to...
On the kishka.
Huh? That's all because you want an excuse. That's because you want an excuse for pastrami kishka, right? But the truth is, in my opinion, and I shared this thought with both Rabbi Morris and Rabbi Leibowitz, and both of them thought my logic was sound, right? I felt for that you most certainly can use the leftovers. And here's my argument. The idea of preparing something for Shabbos, that's a question of Oneg Shabbos. It's not just that I have to eat something extra on Shabbos. It's that I have to get my hands involved in the prep for Shabbos. But that's not what the Ramah brings down when he talks about the Suda. And when he talks about the Suda, all he talks about is the menu, Yarbe. Something should be there extra. How does it get there? So I thought that on, to have it get there from the leftovers, especially leftovers that were prepared for Purim, right? It should certainly fulfill that requirement. And so both of them thought I was logically sound. They both agreed with me that intuitively it makes sense. You're serving extra food, right? There's an extra excitement. And so as Rabbi Sabalevsky put it in this year, the hamantashen don't become chametz only because Purim is over. They'll become chametz 30 days later. But to be able to go ahead and eat a hamantashen l'chaved shushan Purim, he felt that was also, so he said it wasn't usher. I'm going one step further. I think that is an ideal, you know, it's certainly an acceptable way for one to be mekayin yarbe, especially if you want to make hamantashen and you want to include kishka and pastrami. And of course, if you want to include kishka and pastrami in your hamantashen, you want to know how to do this. So I recommend you talk to the guy who updated all of the humor that appeared in our FAQ, right? Whose last name may sound like Busser, right? And I think that you'll discover that you can certainly go ahead and celebrate Purim and Shushan Purim and Shabbos and achieve all at one time. So, of course, it goes without saying that next Thursday night, we're going to be so busy with Mordechai and Esther that we probably won't have our regular shiur. But Bezras Hashem, in 2 weeks' time, we're going to start getting very excited with all the Pesach excitement that's coming around. And let me take the opportunity in this year to wish everyone a Chag Purim Sameach. And may, just like Yehudim Haisa Or V'Simcha V'Sasson V'Kar in the time of Mordechai and Esther, as we say as we end our Shabbos every single week, Kain Tiyalanu. Shabbat Shalom, everyone.
Shabbat Shalom to all.
Yeah.
Kol Tov.